You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
From Shakespeare to Schwartz, from Fosse to Alvin Ailey, from Sondheim to Bareilles, from McNally to Fay, it happened to the greats, it still happens every day. When lightning strikes, it's the moment you know. When lightning strikes, where you're meant to go. You can stand and shout Eureka, do whatever you like. You'll never forget the moment when lightning strikes.
Hi. This is Gerald Brunner, and you're listening to When Lightning Strikes, where we talk about that heart-thumping, tingly, mic-drop moment that led you to becoming an artist. And my guest today is Asmerette Geber-Mikel. Asmerette is a true force on Broadway, off-Broadway, on the West End. She's a Drama Desk winner, and she's been working on Broadway for 20 years in many, many shows. Some of her credits includes The Book of Mormon, Elf, In the Heights, Legally Blonde, Spamalot, Wicked, Dreamgirls on the West End. She was nominated for both the Lucille Lortel and Cheetah Rivera Awards for playing Nikki in the gorgeous production of Sweet Charity. She was in The Wiz Live on NBC. You can watch her in the awesome web series Submissions Only. She currently stars on the BBC TV show Get Even. And Asmerette wrote a beautiful opinion piece for Broadway News called I'm Tired of Being the Token Black Friend. Well, first of all, welcome, Asmerette. How are you?
Thank you so much. I'm good, Gerald. How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm so happy to talk to you and inspired by you. I want to read something in your opinion piece that I found so moving and taught me a lot. You wrote, I encourage you, the producers, the directors, the choreographers, the writers, the composers, the designers, all theater makers, to take a beat. Think about your circle. What does it look like? Does everyone look like you? How can you create opportunities for people of color to join your world? If you can figure out how to make it rain on stage, I believe you can examine your resources and devise ways to combat the institutionalized racism that not only plagues us as a society, but also lives and breathes on the Great White Way. The onus is on you to make a change. People of color are currently coping with the trauma that these most recent racist attacks have triggered. We must now be activists in the middle of a global health crisis. And it's both physically and emotionally exhausting. And you're the ones in control. Don't be sorry, change. Wow, that's really beautiful. I know that was a lot to read. But
it was a lot to write.
So how are you getting through?
Well, I was having a conversation recently with other of my colleagues who are feeling what's going on so deeply as artists of color, and it's a very moment to moment, day by day kind of thing. You know, when all of these when the news first broke about George Floyd and even what happened with Christian Cooper in Central Park. The fact that we're dealing with this pandemic has already put us in a space of anxiety. And then these racial attacks happened and it was double, you know? So, when it first happened, I was feeling grief. I was going through the stages of grief and I was angry and I was anxious and I was sad. And those emotions certainly do come back. But I think in the days and the weeks that I've started to actually lend my voice to what I hope is change being made, I've started to feel a little bit lighter. And I mean, I still have the moments where I see something on social media and it just completely breaks my heart. You know, the other side of us all being home because of this pandemic is that people have a lot of time to post on their Instagram and their Twitter. And so you're getting that, you're just inundated with all this information. And so I've been grateful to see that people are so impassioned, and it feels to me that people are inspired to make change, you know, not just Black people and people of color, but white people as well. So I've sort of run the gamut of emotions. And as a result of that, I've just really gone back to the things that make me feel better, the self-care rituals that I rely on, you know, meditation and therapy and deleting my social media apps if I need a break from all this information and rest, you know, because we're also still dealing with a global health crisis.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's been really eye-opening, I think, because we're all home, but I also think that there's just so much more information and energy out there. So I've just sort of kept an eye on my own mental health in all of this.
We talk about some of your lightning strikes moments. I mean, even this lightning strikes moment of you penning that beautiful opinion piece for Broadway News. You know, what was it that inspired you to share?
Well, you know, in light of what's been happening on a larger scale with police brutality and systemic and institutionalized racism in the country, it's encouraged people to look within and to look at, you know, their day-to-day lives and the workplace. And so I had some colleagues and friends take to the internet and speak up about injustices that they've felt they've experienced and how it made them feel. And I was watching my colleagues and I was really proud that people felt strongly enough to be that vulnerable and share these experiences, because it's not easy, you know? Mm-hmm. And I just started thinking, you know, I've been doing this for a really long time. I have my own experiences. Will it be helpful if I share what I've gone through? And can I inspire someone else to use their voice in that way? And so when I was approached to write the piece, first, there was a wave of anxiety. I was like, I don't know if anyone cares. You know, is it the right time? And as I sat with it, I just went, you know what? Yeah, I feel like I want to, and I feel like it will help other people, even just one person. It will even shed light, you know, because I'm someone who tends to just, you know, as I wrote in my piece, just sort of grin and bear it and you know, make other people feel comfortable. And even before all of this started to come to light, I was having my own moments of, this is not okay for me to do anymore. I don't feel comfortable doing this. And so as actors, we didn't have much power aside from saying no to auditions, you know, just making sure that we were in control of the rooms that we were in on a small level. And so I thought, you know what, we have the floor right now. And this wasn't something that I just thought about overnight. This is 20 years of experience and relationships and perspective. So I just sat down and wrote something pretty quickly, and the response has actually blown me away. I'm you know, it's inspiring to hear people who have been through similar experiences, you know, and it, even if not the same exact, you know, there's something that resonated for a lot of people. And that's been the most inspiring and the most humbling.
You were at NYU 18 years old when you made your Broadway debut. Do I have that right?
That's right, yeah.
Can you tell me about your lightning strikes moment when you knew you had to be an artist? Because you've been dancing for years.
Right? I was dancing for years, yeah. I grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and I remember pretty vividly when it happened. I would come to New York with a group of kids from my studio, and my teacher would drive us in, and we would come and see shows, and we started taking classes at studios like Broadway Dance Center and Steps. Yeah. And I'll never forget, we saw Kiss of the Spider Woman, and Vanessa Williams was playing the lead. And I just remember sitting in the audience and seeing a woman who looked like me front and center starring in this show. And I always loved performing. I knew when I was little that I liked being in front of the camera and being the center of attention because I would make up songs. But this moment when I was 11 or 12 years old really crystallized it for me. And I remember going back to school and we had to write some kind of a report on what we wanted to do. And I remember specifically saying that I wanted to be on Broadway. And I wanted to go to NYU. It's exactly what I said. And I knew nothing about NYU. I was 11, you know, 12 years old. And the only information that I had about NYU was that Theo Huxtable from The Cosby Show went there. And so anytime that they showed him at school, it looked really cool. I was like, this campus is so cool. New York is really like fun looking. And it was the only college that I knew of, you know, but I knew that I had to perform. And so from then on, that was my goal. It just kind of stuck. Now I studied communications at NYU. I didn't study anything performance-based. But I moved to New York so that I could be a part of the action. And I would audition during the day. I would go to school during the day and you know, catch the auditions that I could. And once I got my Broadway show, I was going to school, you know, as regularly scheduled. And then at night I was going and doing my Broadway show.
That is so extraordinary. What was it about that performance and Kiss of a Spider Woman? Well, I mean, incredible production.
Yes.
Gorgeous performer, beautiful music. What was it though about Vanessa Williams and seeing her, that 11-year-old, 12-year-old, that just, how did it make you feel seeing her?
Well, I think it was, I had seen a few other shows and I loved it. You know, I remember seeing all these performances and my first Broadway show and off Broadway shows. And it was exciting. You know, there was no doubt that I loved what I was seeing, but I saw myself in Vanessa Williams. That was the most exciting to me. It made it a reality or something that I could aspire to, because you didn't see, I mean, it's very similar to what I'm talking about now about being the token, but it really, you know, that has shaped who I am today, because, you know, in order to be able to, in order to have dreams, you have to know that they're attainable in some sense, I think, you know, and that made it a very achievable thing for me to see somebody with skin like mine who was dancing, singing, and acting, this amazing triple threat in these glorious, you know, glamorous costumes.
Can you talk about when you got the news that you were cast in your first Broadway show, Footloose? Here you were in college.
I remember vividly because the call was, it was a very last minute audition also. I had auditioned for the show a couple of times prior and I'd get down to the end and then not get the job. And I remember getting a phone call. I was in school. It was my second semester. And I got a phone call to come back in. And I remember I wore the same yellow leotard and had my hair up in this little ponytail. And the creative team knew who I was. But, you know, at this point, one of my childhood friends who I grew up with in the studio was in the show. And they had seen me audition 3 or 4 times, I think, at this point. And I remember it was a last minute call. Someone had been injured, and so they needed someone to start right away. And I remember finishing my singing, and Walter Bobby, the director, asked if I could roller skate. And, you know, you learn from a young age that you just say yes to anything, you know, even if you're like, I'm terrified. You just, you know, so he asked if I could roller skate, and they sort of vocalized me at the piano. And then they just were so, so smiley and just, you know, thanking me for coming in. And I left, and I remember, God, it couldn't have been more than 2 or 3 hours that I got a call from the company manager. I was in my dorm and she told me that I got the job, and I was starting the following Tuesday rehearsals. Okay. I was freaked out. I couldn't believe it. You know, it was not the way that I expected it to be. I didn't expect to be in school, you know, writing papers or whatever I was doing that day. And I called my parents, and I'll never forget this conversation. I told my dad and I told my mom, and my mother just went, well, what about school? And I said, well, what about school? I'll just do both. With, you know, the only optimism that you can have is someone who's making her Broadway debut, who's young and just excited to be, you know, on Broadway. And that's how it went. It was challenging, you know, but I loved it so much and I was so excited. I was a swing, which means that you understudy multiple roles. I was covering 9 female tracks. Oof. And I was a Martin Luther King Jr. scholar at NYU. So I had to maintain a certain grade point average. So when I wasn't on stage, I was in my dressing room, either reading or working on papers that were due. It was a very intense, exciting experience.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
That's so phenomenal. And just to give it even more context, your parents are immigrants, right?
Yes.
From East Africa, from
yes.
a small country called Eritrea.
That's right.
So you're first generation. And mm-hmm. Didn't they come here to the United States because of their education, to get their education? Do I have
yeah,
that right?
That's
your
right.
mom's a nurse. And so I could, on one level, I could understand how she would say, oh, what about your education?
Right.
You know, here you're going to be on Broadway.
Yes. Well, that was the conversation before I even moved to New York. It was, you know, they both came to this country for education. There was a civil war with Ethiopia at the time. And mm-hmm. so they left and with the knowledge that they couldn't go back. At the time, Haile Selassie, who was the leader of Ethiopia, was not having Eritreans back into the country. So they left everything behind, basically, for education and for a new life. And so growing up with that knowledge and wanting to go to New York without either getting a degree or going to school at all, or, you know, getting a degree in the arts, to them just didn't make any sense. Because first of all, culturally, you know, people I think this is common in a lot of immigrant families, where you become an engineer, or you become a doctor, you become a lawyer, you know, you study something in those fields, you know, something that's tangible. And so I grew up with them, you know, saying, well, you have to have something to fall back on. So I knew very early on that it wasn't going to be an option for me to go and study theater or drama or dance or anything. And I just had to prove to them that I was committed to getting a degree in something academic and also pursuing this passion of mine that I loved so much. You know, the irony is that they came here because of their dreams and I was going to New York because of my dreams.
You're not from a family of performers. So
yeah.
where did you get that gorgeous belt
from? Well, I don't come from a family of artists by trade, but my parents are very musical and I grew up listening to them singing all the time. And you know, they're huge, huge music fans. So we grew up listening to Stevie Wonder and the Supremes. And I mean, my mom had a Kenny Rogers phase, you know, there's just, like all types of music. John Denver, there was a John Denver moment in our house. And I do remember a song that I made up. It's, I used to terrorize my little sister, Semhar. And there are countless home videos of me sort of just like forcing her to participate in these games and these songs that I was doing. And there's one video where I'm like, she's crawling around. I force her to stay down on the ground. And I like make this song about her being like my little lamb. So I'm 3 years old or 4 years old and going, my little baby, with all the angst that a 3 or 4 year old can muster. I don't know where this passion came from. I also watched a lot of TV as a kid, so I think it probably stemmed from there. But yeah, it was, everything was really belt centric. I had a lot of unrealized pain or passion at that point.
So you were a very expressive kid, it sounds like.
Yes, very, very. I used to do impressions, and you know, I think my love for comedy came at an early age too, just watching a lot of bloopers shows, and I loved watching sitcoms, and you know, those programs really shaped who I am today as a comedian as well.
What was one of your best impressions?
Oh my God. Sure. Don't ask me. Such a weird kid. I used to do Imelda Marcos. Oh God. I used to do Jesse Jackson. Wow. I watched the news a lot as well. It's just like just bizarre. And I would do a lot of mimicking. So I like to do accents and dialects, which I think later on, because my parents have accents too, I think maybe that's, I had an ear for it. Weird accents.
I love this. Yeah. I love that those choices. Do you remember when they saw you in Footloose, when your parents saw you in Footloose?
Oh, it was surreal.
Yeah.
It was surreal. That they got to come and see me on stage. I think they saw me a few times. I can't really remember now because I was on so frequently and so last minute because I was covering all these different roles. But they've seen me, I think, in everything. I think they've seen me in everything that I've done, with the exception of seeing me star in the Book of Mormon in London. I think they, did they see that? Actually, they did see that. Yeah.
Is it hard to put into words how singing and dancing and performing makes you feel? That's too hard. We can
skip that. That's a good question. No, I think it makes me feel free.
Yeah.
I think it makes me feel free. It's one of the few times in life, I think that I can get out of my head.
Yeah.
And it's just pure joy.
Yeah. Yeah. And also I love that, I mean, that you'll go to the West End. You just had a wonderful run as Laurel, right?
Yes.
In Dreamgirls.
Mm-hmm.
How is it different for you performing over there? Or is it... all depend on the show you're performing on Broadway versus the West End?
Well, I think as actors in New York, it's a dream to get to perform on a West End stage. I think it's something that, if it's not an immediate goal, I think it's something that actors aspire to do, just because, you know, theater in London is incredible, and there's a certain gravitas that comes with performing in, you know, in the West End, on a West End stage, no matter what the production is, you know. And it's rare that an actor gets to do it, and I've gotten to do it twice. I had two experiences that were atypical for being in the West End, just in terms of the audiences. You know, I was in the Book of Mormon yes. and Dreamgirls, and generally, West End audiences and British people are very, you know, reserved and sort of and, you know, very polite. And I was in two shows that were so rowdy audience wise. It was incredible. You know, you had show stopping moments in Dreamgirls, you know, from some of the really well-known musical numbers, and there were just these incredible goosebumps moments. And then with Book of Mormon, because it's so outrageous, you know, the audiences just went nuts. And interestingly, they laugh at different things. You know, I think the Brits make fun of us. And so there were certain jokes that would really land in the West End that were different here, and vice versa. So that was fun. Having done the show in both countries, I was getting a kick out of the different response.
And I love just how eclectic your career is, that how I saw you in Sweet Charity and, and that just delightful, wonderful new group production. And then I love you in Submissions Only, this delightful web series. Here you've had this solid career for 20 years now. How do you get through I've been told is that it's a marathon, you know, having a career like that. But what keeps you going in the industry? How do you stay the course?
Well, I'm a big proponent for self-care. I think that the important thing to remember and to remind yourself of is that you are not the job that you're doing. Because there are going to be breaks in work. There just are. That's just, you know, shows open, shows close. Contracts are not always open-ended, you know. And there were times where I would go from show to show to show. In fact, there was a period of time where I was overlapping. I was rehearsing a new show while I was still in the other show. And so when that little run ended, and I was exhausted and had no idea that I was exhausted. But more than that, I had sort of lost touch with myself and who I was and what I was interested in. It's because I was going to work every day and doing 8 shows a week for years at a time. And so what helped me was just A, to rest, and B, to just really reconnect with who I was outside of all of the shows and the work and the auditions. You know, I think as artists, because we're so personally connected to what it is we do, it can sometimes, you can fall into the trap of identifying yourself by the show that you're in. And so that helped me a lot. Therapy.
Amen. You know, therapy.
I just think it has helped me to stay grounded, and to, I think that the times in between are really important, because they remind you who you are, and they remind you what you want and what you are what you actually like, and they inform the path a little bit, so you're not just blindly saying yes to the next job.
Is there something you wish you could tell that Asmaret, who's just starting in Footloose, the NYU student, who's also on Broadway? Is there something, knowing all you know now, is there something you wish you could say to her?
I would say to her, it's going to work out the way it's meant to. I think it's easy to fall into the trap of comparing your journey to other people's journeys. You know, I'm here and I wish I were this further along, and I wish I were doing what that person were doing, and why didn't I get a call for this? And I just remind myself that my path to getting here was so unique, and that is no different for the path moving forward. I just look at, you know, I look at my career. I look at how eclectic my career has been, and it's just a nice reminder. I don't often look back. But I think, you know, with the time that we have now where everything is shut down, it's been a really nice opportunity to take inventory of my life and my career. Just as sort of information moving forward, you know, to express gratitude for everything that I've been through, to see where I would like to go next. I just think that everyone's journey is so different and so individual. And I think if we can all remember that, that we'll be, you know, we'll sleep a lot better at night.
Yes. Don't you feel like maybe, or at the end of the day, when we see each other as individuals, that's how we go towards the path of healing.
Yes.
You know, not putting people into groups and generalizing who
yes.
they are.
Yeah. I think the gentler we are with ourselves, the gentler we can be with other people. You know, it's,
yeah.
Compassion is such an important trait to hold on to.
People are calling this moment an awakening. There's the beautiful We See You, White American Theater statement from theater artists. How are you seeing behind the scenes pivot?
This has been going on for a long time. And Black people and people of color have been talking about it for years. I think where I'm seeing a pivot is I'm seeing people who are not Black and who this does not directly, immediately affect wake up and start to take a stand with us and for us. You know, this idea of an ally, I think, is really being fine-tuned. And I think people are being asked to not just talk the talk, I mean, to not just walk the walk, but actually what my friend says, you know, walk the talk. Yeah. I'm seeing maybe because we're all at home, people really developing an awareness and starting to educate themselves. And it feels as though people are listening and people are answering this call to action that we've been making for several years. I feel a shift in terms of consciousness.
The people are listening. A friend of mine said she feels, as a woman of color, that sometimes she's energized and yet sometimes she's exhausted.
Yes.
And she runs the gamut of emotions because people are contacting her to ask what they could do,
yeah.
Or apologize. And yeah. I thought it was phenomenal. You have a beautiful quote on your Instagram that, and I'll let you tell it.
Yes. I said, if you can figure out how to make banana bread, you can easily find James Baldwin. I've seen so many, you know, and I was having a conversation with a friend of mine who said, wait, I thought we weren't eating bread anymore. I thought carbs were out. And suddenly, since this pandemic, I have seen more banana bread and sourdough posts on social media than I have in, you know, in Instagram's entire existence. I'm the same. I think, you know, if you are the token Black friend in your circle, or if, you know, people feel comfortable reaching out to you, this experience is not unique. I had a series of emails, phone calls, text messages, you know, with apologies and asking for help in terms of finding resources. You know, actually, the reason why Josh and I got onto Instagram Live that morning is because I said, we're tired. You know,
that was Josh Gad.
It was right. Josh Gad. Yes.
Right. Yeah.
Who's my dear, amazing friend who I'm very grateful. I'm very grateful to him for sharing his platform and using his platform to amplify my voice. We're tired, you know, this is not new for us. And because watching these videos and receiving this information re-triggers us time and time again. It's a lot to go through. And then we're in a global pandemic. And then we have friends of ours asking us where to get this information. Well, you found these recipes. You know how to grow basil in your kitchen now. Certainly you can, you know, use that search engine for something other than carbs.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
So I that sentiment has been echoed a lot. You know, it's a draining time. It's an emotionally draining time. And you know, that's why the other, you know, my other point in my op-ed piece was, you know, don't just be sorry, change. We've heard sorry all these years.
Yes.
So.
Yeah. And it's not up to everyone else to be the solution.
Right.
You could be part of the solution.
Yes.
You know.
And just like all of our stories are different, you know, just as we are not monolithic, there are millions of resources out there. And it's your job to seek them out and see what speaks to you. You know, you may want to examine these nonprofits that exist, and you may want to go out and protest, or you may want to stay home and make phone calls to these people in charge to tell them that you don't agree with what's happening, or the you know, the lull in bringing some of these officers, you know, in arresting them. I think that this whole thing, it has to be personal in order for there to be change.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. It has to resonate with you and feel good. Yeah. So it's almost reaching inside yourself and say, okay, how can I, where's my internal James Baldwin?
That's right. Or my Toni Morrison or my Zora Neale Hurston, you know?
Yes. Yes. Or my Martin Luther King or my.
That's right. Yes. Yes.
Yeah, or my Maya Angelou.
Right, exactly. Or, you know, people like Sean King today, people who are endless resources, you know. There's so many people, you know, depending on, you know, you want a book? Do you want an Instagram account? Do you want a website? You know, there's so much information out there.
What I think is phenomenal is that we don't have to be silent. We can talk about these things. The hope is that we can talk about these things, that there's an open forum.
Yes.
For discussion.
Yes. Yeah. You know, I heard something interesting on TV last night. It was Kamau Bell talking about everything that's happening. And he said Martin Luther King Jr. didn't know that when he was 35, he was going to give this speech. You know, Black people figured this out several years ago during the Civil Rights Movement. So there are going to be mistakes. People, you know, it is expected that you will stumble through these questions and these conversations, but it's really just seeing the action that makes a huge difference. At this point, you can't afford to be silent anymore.
Thank you so much, Asmaret, for taking
thank
the time.
You.
It's just a pleasure to talk to you.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. This is really lovely. It happens every day when lightning
strikes. It's the moment you know. The theme song was written by Tom McGovern. This episode was edited by Kyle Moore, and the talent was booked by Anna Stroud. When lightning strikes.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com, and of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.